I'd like to invite you to open a New Testament to Matthew 26, the place of our reading earlier in our service this morning. Over the past several lessons, we have been examining our together worship, the things that we do corporately as we come together as a body of the Lord's people, and this is the last lesson in this particular series, which, as David alluded to, is going to deal with the Lord's Supper. Memorials do come in a variety of shapes, sizes, a variety of occasions to be remembered. Joel spoke to us earlier about birthdays of famous people, to remember the beginning of a life that has touched our world in some way. But we also remember by statues, by holidays. We remember on perhaps a lesser scale. We remember by school yearbooks, a particular period of our life, time that was special to us as we look back. Flowers and wreaths given on occasion to remember someone. Plaques, even building of entire buildings. Biographies written. Jewelry, rings that are given to memorialize an event, as we've seen this weekend twice. Paintings. We have a need as human beings to remember. And the memorial is because we forget. We tend to forget even very, very important people and events that have taken place in our lives. And God knows that. God understands that. As a part of the old law, there were many, many kinds of memorials instituted that the children of Israel should not forget God and His blessings. As we consider the beginning of the Lord's Supper in Matthew 26 and the other gospel accounts as well, we have Jesus instituting the Lord's Supper during the Jewish Passover feast. It's the last night before He dies that He'll be with the disciples. And this is the beginning of the Jewish Passover. And the Lord's Supper, a memorial that Jesus Himself establishes for Himself, this memorial is established on an occasion that memorialized primarily suffering. The Israelites in the original Passover were certainly suffering greatly at the hands of the Egyptians. They had gone through quite a long period of time of servitude and had come to the point where they felt that they would be delivered now through Moses, their leader. And in fact, initially what happened was the opposite. The suffering increased and things got harder. And it would be difficult for us in our political freedom of the day to imagine the kind of suffering that these people were undergoing. Their male children as born being threatened with death because the Egyptians were wanting to keep the Israelites in servitude. But it was a horrible time of bondage. And leading up to the actual Passover, it was a time of suffering for the Egyptians. In trying to persuade Pharaoh to let the people go, God had brought plague after plague after plague of all kinds of horrendous circumstances to try to pry their fingers off of the Israelites and let them go. And then there was one final great act of suffering to come. And this was going to be the death of the firstborn of the Egyptians. And God had provided stipulations so that the Israelites would be exempt, which involved the slaying of a lamb of certain characteristics and the placing of the blood on the doorposts and the lintel, identifying those that dwell inside this home love God and appreciate God. They are Israelites. But lest we think too shallowly here and think that this was simply a time in the mind of the Israelites of great joy and relief. After all, you know, we're about to be let go and our firstborn are going to be protected. Do you think that's really what they were thinking as death began to spread across the land? And undoubtedly wails could be heard through the night. as death would come to one home and then another home and then another home. This was a horrible time. Yes, the Israelites wanted deliverance and they wanted their freedom, but it was coming at such a great cost, even to their captors. If the Israelites had any shred of decency and humanity within them, they would not have been rejoicing over the deaths, sometimes of small children, sometimes of adults. Wherever the firstborn happened to be in age, they were taken away from the earth. Then as we take a look at Matthew 26, and this Passover feast is being reenacted as it had been frequently since the original Passover. But Jesus is with His disciples, and again, it's a time of suffering. Jesus, first of all, is being betrayed by one of His closest associates. In fact, in 1 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 23, as Paul is recounting the institution of the Lord's Supper, he describes it as the same night on which He was betrayed. That is significant. Jesus undoubtedly is grieving over what is about to transpire. I'll say something about that in a moment. The bigger picture. But undoubtedly Jesus is grieving over the injustice that's being done to Him. The Israelites had been grieving over the injustice done to them by the Egyptians. And here's Jesus thinking about what Judas has prepared in his heart and what he had planned to do even that very night after this sham or this charade of being together with the Lord and the other disciples. What was in his heart was making contact with the Jewish leaders and letting them know exactly where they could find Jesus so he could be arrested without trouble. But I don't think that's even what Jesus is thinking about. That is, that he is being betrayed. Jesus is seeing a soul slip away. He's seeing a loved one, a close disciple, already separated in his heart from Jesus, ignore warning after warning after warning, revealing to Judas whatever he thought in his mind he was doing. However he may have rationalized the betrayal, Jesus has made it clear what the nature of the offense is. And he doesn't turn Judas. He does not persuade Judas to turn and repent. And so Jesus watches a soul slip away. And as he's watching the soul slip away, he's watching this man betray him and make it possible for his arrest to take place. But that's not all. As the meal is ongoing, Jesus has to hear his disciples yet again arguing about which of them should be the greatest when the kingdom comes in its fullness. He's heard this before. He's confronted them before. He's tried to make them understand the nature of their competitiveness and how this is not characteristic of those who will be in His kingdom. They just didn't seem to get it. And here He's contemplating His own horrendous death that is unfolding and suffering the pain of rejection and betrayal and seeing the tragedy unfold before His very eyes, and His disciples really don't yet understand what's ultimately happening. And so Jesus gets up and stoops down, and David said we should be singing that last song on our knees in praise to God. But here's Jesus on His knees carrying out an act of servanthood to His disciples, washing their feet. And even then they don't get it. They don't understand the full significance of what is going on. Have you ever felt alone in a crowd? You feel like there's some great personal struggle that you're having, and it may be in a worship service like this, or it may be at a joyous occasion like a wedding, or you may be with other friends, and you just don't think there's an appreciation as others are around you laughing and carrying on and having a good time, and there you're suffering in your soul, and nobody seems to notice. Jesus is alone in the crowd, surrounded by His disciples, and yet they just do not understand what's going on. And Jesus suffers for that. And then there's just simply the anxiety of the events at hand. That should be point three. My love affair with the PowerPoint continues. There is great anxiety on Jesus' part. He is suffering emotionally. He's going to be suffering physically. He's going to be leaving. There's the pain and the agony of separation from those whom he loves and seeing what it's going to do to them. Jesus is thinking about his own death, undoubtedly. And don't you suppose that there's something in Jesus' mind simply of the moment itself? That is, that all of the focus of the events of mankind and God's interaction with the patriarchs first and then the Israelites and the giving of the law and everything that had transpired through human history was about God bearing the events along, leading to this one moment in time when redemption is going to be provided. Do you ever feel that way when something big is about to happen? I think we probably had a couple of brides feel that in the last couple of days. Even a wonderful, joyous event is shrouded in this tension. Even though what's about to happen is a good thing in terms of a wedding, boy, nerves are jangling and everybody's on edge and you want everything to go just right, but you're also thinking about the moment. The moment. I think Doug might have been thinking about the moment last night. The father. Thank you. The father coming to the moment of giving his daughter away. The daughter coming to the moment of the beginning of her life with her new husband. Just simply the anxiety associated with the significance of the things that happen in life. And nothing is more significant than Jesus about to die. And so it's a time of suffering for Jesus to institute the supper. It's set against the backdrop of suffering from the Passover. And as we indicated earlier, here's Jesus establishing his own memorial. Would that not be somewhat presumptuous for just an average man to build his own memorial or establish some sort of an event to memorialize himself, and yet Jesus is no average man. Jesus is doing this not for his own glory, but he's doing it for the good of mankind so that we will not forget. So that we will be able to remember the most significant event that's ever happened on this earth. Jesus says, "Take, eat, this is my body. Drink all of you from it. This is my blood." And so in Matthew chapter 26, it's page 669 in the Pew Bible, we have this account. Verse 26, as they were eating, Jesus took bread, blessed it, and broke it and gave it to the disciples and said, "Take, eat, this is my body." Then he took the cup and gave thanks and gave it to them, saying, "Drink from it, all of you. For this is my blood of the new covenant, which is shed for many for the remission of sins." The memorial that Jesus establishes is not like the erection of a monument chiseled in granite for the world to see for ages to come, to which men have to go to where the monument is to observe it. Jesus takes very simple elements, the elements used in the Passover supper, elements that are fairly common found around the world. Jesus takes these elements and something in addition to the Passover is happening. They're eating the meal as prescribed by the law of Moses, but at a certain point, or actually at two different points during the meal, in regard to the cup, it's after the meal, Jesus takes those very elements that had just been used in observing the Passover and says, "Now I want you to take of it again. And I want you to eat of the bread, because this is my body." And there has been so much confusion about that so much false teaching about it. What is the nature of the bread? What is the nature of the fruit of the vine? And some religious groups have even taught that in some mysterious sense, these emblems even become the body and become the blood. You know, the multitudes listening to Jesus teach in John 6 made that mistake. When Jesus was talking about eating his flesh and drinking his blood, he was speaking figuratively. And Jesus is speaking symbolically here. These are the things that I am prescribing to remember, memorialize, symbolize my body and my blood. Let me show you a passage in the Old Testament. In 1 Chronicles chapter 11, page 284 in the Pew Bible. 1 Chronicles chapter 11. Story is being told here sort of retrospectively of some things that had happened in David's life. While he was separated through warfare from his home, we find that David is longing, 1 Chronicles chapter 11 and verse 17, he's longing for a drink of water out of the well in Bethlehem. And he laments in verse 17, "Oh, that someone would give me a drink of water from the well of Bethlehem, which is by the gate." And his disciples, followers, fellow soldiers, as they, being loyal to David, heard this lamentation. It says, three, in verse 18, broke through the camp of the Philistines, drew water from the well of Bethlehem that was by the gate, and took it and brought it to David. What a wonderful tribute this was to their loyalty, their love for David, their concern. Their great leader is longing for a drink out of the hometown well, as it were, and they said, "We're going to go get him some. We're going to go get him that water." Nevertheless, David would not drink it, but poured it out to the Lord. Sounds like a rather unappreciative thing to do. And he said in verse 19, "Far be it from me, O my God, that I should do this. Shall I drink the blood of these men who have put their lives in jeopardy? For at the risk of their lives they brought it, therefore he would not drink it. These things were done by the three mighty men." A couple of things there. Number one, David says, "This is the blood of these men." Well, was it? It was water from the well of Bethlehem. What is David saying? He said, "This water represents these men's lives. They risked their lives to get me this drink of water." And he says, "I'm not going to drink the blood of these men." And the second thing that's interesting here is not drinking was an honor to them. And so we have something, I think, of a similarity and something of a difference in this story and what Jesus is doing with the Lord's Supper. "This is my blood. This is my body." Literally, no. No, what he's saying is, "I'm about to give my body and shed my blood as the all-satisfying sacrifice of God for the sins of all mankind, past, present, and future. And I want you to remember this sacrifice. Here's my body," and he gives them the bread. "Here is my blood," and he gives them the cup, the fruit of the vine. In this case of remembering the Lord and His death, it's by drinking and by eating that we honor Him, not by refraining from doing so, as was the case of David with his mighty men. And so what we have is, in the emblems that Jesus has left for us, a memorial. A universal memorial. Not some place we all have to traipse to or make a pilgrimage once in our lives, something to go see and visually behold, but a memorial that is portable, if you will. A memorial that's universal. A memorial that can be observed whenever and wherever, because it's really not the emblem. It's not the beauty of the carved marble or granite. It's not the imposing size of the statue that impresses us. It's what it represents, what the bread and the fruit of the vine represent. Well, in 1 Corinthians chapter 11... we're told that in observing the Lord's Supper as He has prescribed, We have more than just a memorial for ourselves. We have a proclamation. Not just something for our private reflection, but in observing the Lord's Supper and doing so, even as we've done in this public assembly. We're not sitting on a street corner somewhere, although we could do that. But we're in a public assembly. And in the course of so observing this death, in verse 26 of 1 Corinthians 11, as often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death till He comes. And what we find in other verses, particularly Acts chapter 20, verse 7, it is a weekly proclamation, a weekly memorial. And I don't know the significance of the Holy Spirit revealing the frequency only in one passage and only then by way of example. I don't think that's insignificant. It may to some degree be a test of how willing we are to look back at the time of original revelation, to look at the lives of apostles who were representatives of the Lord, to consider their actions and their behavior as they went about worshiping God, which is what we have in Acts 20 and 7. Paul being assembled together with Christians in Troas, coming together on the first day of the week to break bread. That's the example. And an apostle is present who certainly knows the import of the event. What does he say here in 1 Corinthians 11? I receive from the Lord that which also I delivered unto you. That's a pretty strong suggestion that Paul knows how to observe this memorial. And it was weekly on the first day of the week, and that's a day of great significance in the New Testament. It's the day of Jesus' resurrection. It's the day on Pentecost where Peter and the other apostles began to proclaim entrance into the kingdom. It's also the day, perhaps incidentally, that the collection is taken up, which we talked about last week. On the first day of the week, let every one of you lay by in store. Indicating that there's a growing concept in these passages, this was a day of significance to New Testament Christians. A day of being together to worship. A day of corporate joining together to sing and pray and study and observe the Lord's Supper on the first day of the week. And then, of course, the specific reference in Acts 20 and 7. And so it's a proclamation as well as a memorial, and it's a weekly one, whereas the Passover had been merely an annual one. And it's fitting. We don't have to explain God, but it's fitting that we do this weekly. And we reflect on a continual basis what has been done for us and the price that has been paid that we might be people of God. In chapter 11 and verse 26, again of 1 Corinthians, as often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death till He comes. And I'm not sure that's merely a statement of duration, it may be, but certainly as it's done until He comes, certainly brings to mind the fact that He is coming. That there is not only a looking back to the death of Jesus and the body that was given on the cross, the blood that was shed, but something that we are continuing 2,000 years later because we believe He's coming. And since He hasn't come yet, we fulfill the command relative to the memorial and we observe it weekly till He comes. Go back a page or so in 1 Corinthians to chapter 10. This is in discussion of Christians going into idols' temples and eating meals that had been actually sacrificed to idols. And I don't know, maybe crossing your fingers and putting it behind your back and saying this really doesn't count because I don't really believe in idols. And they were making excuses for themselves and convincing themselves it was okay to associate in such practices. But Paul is addressing these people who on the Lord's Day eat the Lord's Supper and on other days through the week, rationalizing going into idols' temples and eating food sacrificed to the idols or offered in honor to the idols. And this is what he says in answering that practice. Verses 16 and 17 of chapter 10. The cup of blessing which we bless, is it not the communion of the blood of Christ? The bread which we break, is it not the communion of the body of Christ? For we, being many, are one bread and one body. For we all partake of that one bread. In verse 20, I say that the things which the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to demons and not to God. I do not want you to have fellowship with demons. That's the same word as communion back in verse 16. I do not want you to commune with demons or commune with the people who are communing with demons. Perhaps the argument in the minds of these people was, well, an idol is nothing. Paul addresses this in chapter 8. Well, there's no substance to an idol, so how can I get in trouble by observing a meal that's being offered to nothing? Well, it's true there is no real personality behind the idol, but what Paul is saying is idolatry is a work of the demons. And people are persuaded to believe in divine beings that don't exist by virtue of the carved statue and the worship services to the idols. And even prostitution at times was a matter of worship unto the idol. But the point I want you to see here is that Paul is saying, as we observe the Lord's Supper, it is a sharing, a fellowship, I think in two ways. Number one, with each other. And Russ mentioned this in his prayer. The blessing it is that we can gather together and share. And this is what one of the elements we've been pointing out about our corporate worship, our mutual worship together. We're together drawing strength from each other, praising God together, and accomplishing something in this that cannot be accomplished, though we can offer worship to God alone. We can sing praises to God alone, and certainly we can pray alone. But there's a different dynamic and there's a different element as we come together and we, with our brethren, sing and pray and especially observe the Lord's Supper. We are communing with each other and we're also communing with the Lord. And this particular element takes this observance out of merely the realm of memorial, that is, looking to the past about some event that took place, and it brings it into the present. We are enjoying communion with the Lord, an active, conscious interaction with the Lord as we are observing this supper, and we are contemplating as He sits now at the right hand of God in heaven. We're contemplating the fellowship we have with Him by virtue of His death. The mind must be engaged in what we're doing. This is not like a mere ceremony that draws a crowd. If you've been maybe to the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier in Washington, D.C., you know that that goes on constantly. In fact, I read an article the other day that in the remnants of some of the hurricanes from last year, just Washington was having torrential rains and storms and lightning, and they suggested to the men who carry on that guard, you know, we're willing to suspend this until these violent storms pass. And the men said, absolutely not. And they went out and they kept marching back and forth and back and forth before the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, whether anybody was there or not. But nonetheless, that is a sort of a memorial, that's a ceremony that's ongoing that draws a crowd or maybe doesn't draw a crowd. But when we observe the Lord's Supper, we are communing. We are in fellowship with the Lord and with each other. He's not just a being that is dead and gone. So while it is a memorial, it is not merely a memorial. He's present with us. He observes what we're doing. He looks into our hearts. He knows whether we're worshiping or whether we're distracted. And then down in 1 Corinthians 11 again, in verses 27 and following. This context, of course, of 1 Corinthians 11 is against the backdrop of corruption. The Lord's Supper has been corrupted among these brethren and turned into a common meal wherein there's a socioeconomic division of the brethren, the haves, the rich, partaking of a full meal and sating themselves in the course thereof, while the poorer brethren who may come in later don't have enough to provide for themselves, and so there's a division. And Paul is very pointed in what he's saying to these brethren. In fact, early on, he says, you're not coming together for the Lord's Supper. In verse 20, therefore, when you come together in one place, it's not to eat the Lord's Supper. You may think that's what you're doing, but in your practice, you're not eating the Lord's Supper. You so corrupted it, it doesn't resemble the true memorial feast that the Lord established. You've turned this into competitiveness. You've turned this into a division, a social division. And he's trying to correct them. And so what he ends up saying to them in verses 27 through 29 is, there needs to be some introspection, self-examination going on to see why it is you're doing this. Therefore, whoever eats this bread or drinks this cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner will be guilty of the body and the blood of the Lord. But let a man examine himself, and so let him eat of that bread and drink of that cup. For he who eats and drinks in an unworthy manner eats and drinks judgment to himself, not discerning the Lord's body. Have you ever heard someone say, perhaps you've noticed, they didn't partake of the Lord's Supper? Or otherwise, you have a conversation with someone, and they may volunteer, you know, I didn't partake of the Lord's Supper because there's just some things not right in my life, and I don't feel worthy. Folks, there ain't none of us worthy to be doing this. This is not just a question about moral excellence. When he talks about being worthy in verse 29, he's talking about the manner in which the supper is being observed. Look at his language. He who eats and drinks in an unworthy manner. It may be that we're experiencing guilt and our conscience, we're at odds with our conscience because on the one hand, we know we've done something we shouldn't have done. On the other hand, here we are taking the Lord's Supper. The solution to that is not to not take the Lord's Supper. The solution to that is to confess our wrongs. By virtue of what's happening in the Lord's Supper, that is, Jesus died that our sins could be taken away. We need to fix the problem. We need to address why it is our conscience is convicting us. And that is more immediate, really, than the Lord's Supper, in a sense. You know, when Jesus talked about bringing your gift to the altar and you have something at odds with someone else, and he talks about the immediacy of fixing that problem. Well, I think we have the same thing here. If I have an issue between me and the Lord, the issue really isn't should I take the Lord's Supper, it's how long am I going to let this go? How long am I going to walk in jeopardy? Why have I not fixed this thing between myself and the Lord? And then I'm enabled to take the Lord's Supper and memorialize His death with a clear conscience. Paul speaks of the brethren in verse 30 here being weak and sickly and many sleep. And he says if we would judge ourselves, we would not be judged in verse 31. The Corinthian brethren are spiritually sick. The epistle addresses it over and over in various ways. They're spiritually sick. And he says you need to be judging yourselves and examining yourselves, especially since you have corrupted the Lord's Supper into something entirely that it was not designed to be. You've forgotten to memorialize the death of the Lord and be humble in His sight and thankful. And you're just at each other's throats in competitiveness. And so the observance is about the emblems being a memorial and the proclamation of the Lord's death until He comes, the anticipation of that return, the fellowship that we have even in that moment of observance with the Lord and with each other in our self-examination. And so the Lord has said, by the example of the Christians in Troas, do this weekly. to help keep you healthy, to remember that your whole life revolves around me and my death. Again, as David noted in the bulletin Wednesday night, the Lord's Supper is not merely an intellectual exercise, that we're just reading passages blindly from the New Testament. It's something that our spirits are engaged in. Not merely that we're aware of the death of the Lord, but I have an opportunity, as was even said this morning, to thank Him for that death and to reflect on the fact that it is for me. It was for me, and I live by virtue of what He did. And you know, as Jesus is instituting the supper, there's Judas. He's going through the motions of the Passover, but betrayal is in his heart. And so we might need to ask ourselves as we partake of the Lord's Supper, am I doing this sincerely? What is in my heart as I eat the bread and drink the cup? Judas was keeping up appearances. Is that maybe what we do? We come together with the brethren and we go through the motions of worship, but yet we leave here and we can't wait to be somewhere else with other friends doing other things, running so completely contrary to the principles of observing the Lord's Supper. And it's a time of individual reflection. What does this mean to me? Yes, we're a group doing it, but what does it mean to me? Am I concentrating? Am I aware? Is my heart in it? Is this something I look forward to during the week because of the opportunity to honor the Lord and figuratively get down on our knees and remember His death? And to be renewed once again, perhaps, in our devotion to Him who died for us. Again, this is the memorial that Jesus left Himself for us, that we might draw closer and closer to Him as we observe this regularly through life. And you know, when we become a Christian, that in essence is what we're doing. We're making a date, as it were. We're establishing an appointment for the first day of the week, for the rest of our life. When we come to the Lord and we obey Him and we declare that we want to be His disciples and His children and be in the family of God, one of the things we do in that process is we declare, Lord, I'm going to commune with You. Especially in this way, every first day of the week, that I have opportunity to do so until I die. That's one of the commitments that we make to the Lord. And I hope and pray that as we observe the Lord's Supper even this morning, that some of these things were in your heart and there was an awareness of exactly what it was we were doing. But we're in this for the long haul if the Lord lets us live. This is a weekly observance till we die. It's something we need to work on all of the time to see that we're worshiping God, to praise Him as we should, but that we're also edifying ourselves and each other in the way that God has prescribed, which is what we've been looking at these last few weeks. How has God told us to worship so He is glorified and our souls are built up? Have you made that commitment to the Lord yet in your life? You committed to be with Him every first day of the week for the rest of your life? To be with His people, to help them and grow together with them and worship God? Is that part of your life? And if not, we want to urge you to think about that commitment that needs to be made. And if we can help you in that, we're going to sing a song designed to give you an opportunity to reflect, to come forward if you need to, so that we might have opportunity to help you obey the Lord in any way that may be lacking in your life. Can we help you while we stand and sing?